I feel like I have to apologize a bit. Some people say I apologize too much for what I do, but I'm going to read this paper rather than speak off the cuff, where I feel more comfortable doing that. But since there's so much to say, sometimes you run into other things. I hope it won't. I hope I won't drone on and put you to sleep. But there is a bit of substance in substantial stuff, statistics and things like that. So I thought it'd be better if I stuck to a text. So so that's what I'm going to do. What has contextual theology to offer the church of the 21st century? Now, in order to answer the question of this lecture, at least in some partial way, I'd like to proceed in three steps. First of all, I'm going to try to answer the question, what is the church in the 21st century? And then second, I'm going to try to answer the question, what is contextual theology? And then with the answers to these first two questions, and ironically, of course, they're the questions of context, I think I and we will be in a position to answer the third and original question, what has contextual theology to offer the church of the 21st century? So let's begin with part one. What is the church of the 21st century? First thing I want to say is that it's a church of great diversity. First and most important thing one can say about the church today is that it's impossible to say much in general about it. It's incredibly diverse. And if we can speak about its mark of Catholicity, we have to speak about its unity in diversity rather than its universality. I'm going to set out a number of characteristics of the church in the 21st century in this section, but not everything I say fits every church, and possibly nothing I say will describe one or the other church. The church today ranges from struggling URC and Anglican congregations in the UK to rapidly expanding Pentecostal communities in Brazil and Nigeria, to vibrant but low-profile house churches in China, to groups of believers in Jesus who choose to remain Muslim in almost every way. So ours is a truly Catholic church, and it is impossible, I think, to generalize it, about it. We can say, however, that our church of the 21st century has definitely become a global church, a world church, with the vast majority of Christians from the so-called two-thirds world or majority world. This is something, thanks to scholars like Andrew Walls and Laman Sane, that we have known for some time, but let's make a quick review of the facts using David Barrett's, Todd Johnson's, and Peter F. Crossing's statistics published in the January 2009 issue of the International Bulletin for Missionary Research and the World Christian Database that you can find online. Just about a century ago, in 1900, there were 521,712,000 Christians in the world. In 2009, say Barrett, Johnson, and Crossing, there are 2,149,761,000. At the present rate of growth, which is 1.35% per year, there will be almost 2.6 billion Christians 15 years hence in 2025. The growth of Christianity is across the board, but where the growth has been most astonishing is in the majority world. While the growth of Christians in Europe and North America has averaged 0.12%, and 0.66% respectively per year since 1800, Africa has grown by a yearly rate of 2.59%. Asia, even with its minority of Christians, has grown 2.48% annually. Latin America has grown 1.17%, and Oceania has grown by 1.10% every year. The continent of Europe still has the largest number of Christians, about 531 million, projected at 539 million by 2025, and North America has about 221 million, with the projection of about 20 million more in 15 years. However, Africa, at the end of 2009, has a Christian population of 447 million, projected in 15 years to 662 million. Asia is at 366 million and will be at 490 million by 2025. Latin America has a population of 531 million, projected by 2025 at 623 million. And Oceania now has 23 million Christians and will have 26 million in a decade and a half. In 1900, the largest Catholic country in the world was France. In 2009, the first three largest Catholic countries are Brazil, Mexico, and the Philippines. As Andrew Walls sums it up, Christianity began the 20th century as a Western religion, and indeed the Western religion. It ended the century as a non-Western religion, on track to become progressively more so. For many churches, For many churches in Africa and the church in Latin America and perhaps Oceania, Christianity will make up the majority of the population. For the church in Asia, Europe, and North America, New Zealand, and Australia, however, Christians are now and will continue to be in the minority. China, however, with 1.2 billion people, has only about 100 million Christians by a generous count. India's population of 1 billion contains about 52 million Christians, and Indonesia's 27 million Christians make up less than 10% of the country's 226 million people, even though these are more Christians than the entire population of, say, Australia. We all know from personal experience how the Christian population of Europe, Australia, and New Zealand is diminishing. My country of the United States is still quite religious, but it too is going the way of Europe. What this means for the church of our 21st century is that many of us exist in a kind of diaspora situation. For some churches, like the Church of Indonesia and India, for example, it means living, worshiping, and doing mission in the context of an overwhelming non-Christian population. For others, like China and Vietnam, it means being Christian in a situation of suspicion and even persecution, subtle or not so subtle. For still other Christians, like here in Britain or in North America, we will live out our Christianity in a state that is more and more secular and in a society that is more and more multicultural and multi-religious, which is my next point. We live in a world today of significant shifts in population. Since about the mid-1960s, we have seen major movements of migration in Africa, Asia, Oceania, and Latin America, to the wealthier parts of the world that a century ago were the colonizers of these areas. There is significant migration from Africa to Europe and North America, from Asia and Oceania to Australia, New Zealand, North America, and Europe, and from Latin America to North America. The migrant populations today are not like those of the past, whose goal was to assimilate themselves into the receiving culture. Rather, there is a strong effort to maintain cultural and religious identity. Our churches reflect the richness and the difficulties of these situations and are profiting from its multiculturality is a major challenge. At the same time, there is and there will continue to be a kind of assimilation of the various cultures. However, this assimilation seems more and more to be not so much an assimilation into the dominant culture as an assimilation into a totally new culture that is the result of the blending of many diverse cultures in today's world. Soon after the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States, I saw a video essay on US public television about an art exhibit at some American university. The exhibit consisted of a collection of portraits of young women and men who were of mixed race, like the newly elected president. And next to each face was listed the combination of races and cultures that contributed to each person's identity. One young man described himself, for example, as Filipino, Kenyan, white, and Chilean, while a young woman described herself as African-American, Samoan, and British. Next to his picture, one young man wrote, "I am the face of the future." This is a future that is not far away. In fact, it is with us now in our churches as we try to live the gospel in the 21st century. I want to talk about the fact that the church of the 21st century is a young church. Once again, this description might not fit all the churches of the world. However, it does fit the churches of Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Oceania, and the large numbers of people from these churches who have migrated to the churches of Australia, New Zealand, Europe, and North America. According to the World's Youth 2006 data sheet, posted by the Population Reference Bureau in Washington, D.C., by 2025, only 17% of the population in affluent countries, so Australia, U.S., France, Japan, will be under 24. In 2005, it was 19%. In contrast, in countries with the least affluent populations, in contrast, in countries with the least affluent population, around 27% of the population will be 24 or younger. One would think that these statistics would obtain as well among peoples who have migrated to more affluent countries. Our church of the 21st century, especially where the church is flourishing, will be young, with more than one in four under 24 years old. Our churches will have to work at reaching and keeping the young. And we can talk about a persecuted church as well. I didn't want to put any real gory pictures. This is a picture of a bombed out church in Vietnam. So let that stand for what I'm going to say. The church in the one-third or minority world is and is becoming a marginalized church. In many parts of the world, however, the church is also a persecuted minority. In the last years, we have heard about church bombings in Pakistan and Iraq, and missionaries and local Christians murdered in India. In Latin America, we still hear of church leaders and church members murdered for their stands on social justice. Several countries like Indonesia have laws that forbid citizens from converting to Christianity. And some states in Nigeria have decided that Muslim Sharia law is the law of the land. Barrett, Johnson, and Crossing perhaps exaggerate, but they estimate that there have been 176,000 Christian martyrs in 2009 alone. For a good number of our churches today, being a Christian means taking a risk, being under persecution. In the past, the majority of Christians lived in the most affluent part of the world. Now, the majority of Christians live in the poorest part of the world. The church of the 21st century is and will continue to be a poor church. This is particularly the case since, with the decreasing numbers of church members in the minority world, there will be fewer and fewer funds available to share with other less affluent churches. One example of this is my own Catholic missionary congregation, the Society of the Divine Word. In the past, our generalate in Rome was able to distribute tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars for the work of our congregation in Papua New Guinea, Mexico, Philippines, Ghana, and so forth. In the last several years, this annual distribution has simply not been able to do what it had done in the past. The money is simply not there. One implication of this situation for theological and church leadership is that there will be less funding for women and men from the majority world to travel to the more affluent countries for their theological and graduate education. Theological education will be more homegrown, local, or students will be sent to other parts of the majority world. In my own religious congregation, we already see this. Many of our young confreres from India, Indonesia, and China are being sent to be educated in the Philippines rather than to Rome, Europe, or to the United States. And Filipinos, too, are staying at home for their education. This may not guarantee a more contextual theological education, but the possibilities are there. Often one hears that a fourth self should be added to Henry Venn's famous three, and that is self-theologizing. Perhaps through necessity, this will be able to happen in the church in the 21st century. There may be an added blessing to this financial crisis in the minority, once wealthy churches. Such a situation will perhaps ensure that local churches in every part of the world would live more simply and identify more with the situation of the people they serve. Perhaps for the first time since before the Constantinian era of the church in the 21st century is in a position to be a poor church, for the poor, with the poor, and of the poor. This is a thumbnail sketch of the church in the 21st century. There may be other aspects which I have, of course, not touched. For instance, the church in the midst of drastic climate change. But I believe that what we've sketched here gives a pretty good picture of the church to which contextual theology might have something to offer. It is an overwhelmingly majority world church, one that is concerned with local cultures and local cultures and social locations, one that is richly multicultural and lives in a multi-religious world, one that is very young, one that is a minority and often persecuted. In the minority world, the church is marginal to society on the one hand, and where it flourishes, composed of many cultures and traditions. In sum, our church in the 21st century is a far cry from the church of a century ago, or perhaps even half a century ago. Ours is a church, as I will suggest, that needs a theology that is thoroughly contextual on the one hand and global or intercultural on the other. So we come to our second point, which is, what is contextual theology? As I've described or defined contextual theology in the second edition of my book, Models of Contextual Theology, contextual theology is a way of doing theology that takes into account, or we could say puts in mutually critical dialogue, two realities. The first of these is the experience of the past, recorded in Scripture and preserved and defended in the church's tradition. The second is the experience of the present, or a particular context, which consists of one or more of at least four elements: personal or communal experience, secular or religious culture, social location, and social change. Now, depending on a number of circumstances, one's understanding of God's revelation, one's attitude toward human experience, one's understanding of the normativity of Scripture or tradition, one might choose to enter into the mutually critical dialogue between past and present according to one or a combination of the six models I attempt to sketch out in my book. Each one of these models, I believe, is valid. There is not one model that is objectively better than the others. And yet, the true validity of a model comes with its experience within a particular context. If the context is a homily that an Australian pastor would have to deliver in the aftermath of last February's devastating bushfires in the southern state of Victoria, she might draw on the cherished values of courage and sacrifice, which are found deep in the Australian psyche. Or as a friend of mine told me, who is a pastor in the town of Alexandra, Victoria, which was in danger of being in the fire's path and near many of the burned areas, his congregation came together often and just kept silence, since there were no words to express their grief, although they did pray occasionally from the Book of Lamentations. If one is in a discussion of white, middle-class British youth, one might reflect on how countercultural the message of Jesus could be in this affluent society today. Or, as British theologian Pete Ward might argue, one might help youth reflect on the spiritual meanings and struggles reflected in hip-hop culture or young people's clothing styles. Or finally, if you are trying to give examples from a context which is not your own, like I've just done, you make an attempt to translate your experience and faith into examples and language that the people in that context might understand.